three-day test match in Ahmedabad, following the two-day one also in Ahmedabad, an innings defeat for England this time around on the tracks of a 10-wicket loss the previous time. India have wrapped up the fourth test match by an innings and 25 runs on day three. England bowled out for 135 in their second innings. India taking the series 3-1 and romping their way into the World Test Championship final, where they will take on New Zealand sometime in June. Hello and welcome to Hotspot Daily with me, Chetan Narula, and my friend Daniel Norcross in London. Daniel, we promised our listeners that we'll come to you at least three times, and we're keeping up that promise.
Yes, but yes.
You said if England needed to bat two sessions out, 60, 70 overs, there's every chance this test match could end on day three, and it has.
Yes, it has. And it was an unedifying sight, really, for England supporters and for England players. There were some really horrible dismissals in there today. It's a terrific bowling again from Akshar Patel and Ravichandran Ashwin. But, you know, I'm afraid it had that feel to it. It reminded me a little bit when I was a youngster of watching England against the West Indies. And they would go with modest hopes. And even those modest hopes would be blasted away in repetitive fashion by, you know, fast bowlers, Patrick Patterson and Holding and Marshall and what have you.
Yeah, yeah.
And we would sort of watch the games or listen to the games with that sense of inevitability. And it's a very similar story here. I mean, if you told England at the start of the series that India wouldn't pass 400 once, that Virat Kohli would average 19 or 20 or whatever it was he did at the end of this series, and similarly for Pujara, they'd have bitten your hand off. But unfortunately, what they couldn't have expected was that their batters just wouldn't be able to withstand the relentless pressure, the excellent accuracy, the pace at which India's spinners bowled. And they didn't help themselves. I mean, I think we'll no doubt dissect various conundrums of England's selection, people coming in and out of the side, you know, changing four players when they've won the first game. And just look at how Johnny Bairstow had his winter interrupted. It was going so well in Sri Lanka. And then today he collected his sixth duck in 9 innings against India. His last 9 innings, he's averaged 5.66 poor thing. And today he got out to just one of those moments that happens when everything is going wrong for you. Just a little flick down the leg side to his first ball, caught it, leg slip. And there was a bit of that going on today for England. We saw it in like Dom Sibley's dismissal, you know, smashing sweep straight into the knee of Shubman Gill, and then it bounces kindly up in the air, or lobs, I should say, up to Rishabh Pant. Various things that could go wrong did go wrong. There was the odd bright spark, not many. Dan Lawrence's innings were, well, it's a poser for the selectors coming into England's summer.
Yeah.
But looking back on the series as a whole, you'd have to say, when England went into it, I predicted 4-0. India had only lost one game at home in the last 9 years. So if you put on paper England lose 3-1, you'd say, well, that's not a bad result. But the manner of the last couple of defeats has been a salutary lesson about how to play quality spin bowling.
Before we go ahead, I'll just talk about Johnny Bairstow. I mean, I like Johnny Bairstow, and he's a good player of spin. But this series, well, it has been an eye-opener. He's just not there mentally. I mean, I understand the series was broadcast on free-to-air television in UK, and a lot of younger generation probably tuned in to watch cricket for the first time, apparently. And if they saw this for the first time, they would think Johnny Bairstow is the worst batsman in world cricket at the moment, or ever, which is not true. And they would think that Akshar Patel is the greatest spinner to have bowled in cricket, which is also not true. And I mean, it's been that kind of a series. It's been that kind of a series for England, like you mentioned, that the last two matches, I think that's what defines the last two matches, because I have been talking about this throughout the series and throughout on this podcast that, look, India lost that first test match. They said, okay, you know what? The challenge we got was from the English spinners and the reverse swing of James Anderson. He's not going to have reverse swing in every match. So the challenge is for the English spinners. Now, we have better spinners than Jack Leach and Dom Bess and, okay, Joe Root. That we have better spinners. Let's make spin-friendly tracks. Let's take the equation out where England have 500 on the board and then they put us under pressure. That's what they did. That's what those pitchers did. they did not allow the English batsmen to score that mountain of runs. England won the toss in this particular test match in Ahmedabad in the fourth test, and they were shot out for 205. That is not good enough. So that's what India did. They took out those mountain of runs thanks to the pitchers, because they have better spinners, and then their batsmen showed better class or better temperament in terms of batting. England, for me, they saw those two pitchers in the last two test matches or the last three test matches, and they lost the mental battle. Okay. They were not fighting the spinners. They were not fighting the deliveries that Akshar Patel and Ravichandran Ashwin were bowling at them. They were fighting the pitch. And when you're fighting the pitch, I think that's half the battle lost. The bowler has won, and there's no surprises why Akshar Patel and Ashwin came out on top in the manner that they did.
I agree. And the concerning thing on one level is it's very hard to know how England can get better, or indeed many teams. You know, this isn't a problem that's solely England's. Every team that's gone to India in the last 9 years has struggled, but struggled big time. So this isn't something that's confined to English batters. What's difficult to know is how they can find themselves in a place where they can prepare for such a challenge the next time. The wonderful thing about India is they have flexibility in their approach. They can either decide to take you on seaming wickets because they've got a great fast bowling battery, or they can decide to take you on by scoring a mountain of runs because they've got batters who can bat for long periods of time, or they can do you on fast turning pitches. Now, the problem for England was that they didn't know what was going to happen. So they found themselves almost being outmaneuvered. They were sort of playing the previous test match each time, which was a very curious thing to watch. And they, you know, when a side goes to Australia, they know exactly what they need to do. They know what the pitches are going to be like, and they know what the battle is going to be. In India, you're not quite sure, although you suspect that you're not going to be good enough for whichever scenario turns up.
If I want to add to that, I mean, what England can do at best is they can go to the ICC Academy in Dubai and say, okay, you know what, prepare slow wickets, because there are different type of wickets over there. You get different bouncers, you get Indian wickets, Australian wickets, South African wickets, probably not English wickets, because English wickets is partly the weather, not just the wicket, it's also the weather. So you can't replicate English conditions, at least outdoors. So you get an Australian bounce, South African bounce, South African soil, Australian soil. They had. I went there in 2019 or 2018, in fact, and one of the pitches was made from the soil from Wacha in Perth. And I was told that it has extraordinary bounce, and I was very impressed to see that. So what English batsmen can do is they can go to Dubai and have those camps. But the problem is, when you have such camps, you do not have such camps on rank turners. You know, you have a slow wicket with normal amount of spin, which is what perhaps we had in Chennai, the first test match. The spin was accentuated in the second, third, and fourth test match. And obviously in the third test match, we also had the pink ball. So you're right. There's no way you can prepare for it, which is why the Sri Lankan tour was perhaps a good preparation. But even then, the pitches there were normal spin pitches.
The goal pitch turned. They definitely turned. And they turned slightly in the manner perhaps of a UAE pitch or a standard Sri Lankan pitch, or perhaps, again, a little bit like, say, a Chittagong.
Yeah.
But it wasn't like the way these turned. I'm not for 1 minute saying that, you know, that these are bad pitches as a result. I'm just saying that the conditions are different. So it looks like preparation, and to a degree it was preparation. But, you know, I think England will have to take a deep breath and say, well, wait a minute, we've played six tests on the subcontinent this winter. We won three. We lost three. It's not a catastrophe. We play in India every 4 years. And look, we've said this at the beginning of the series, England have clearly prioritised squad rotation, keeping their players fit, mentally healthy in these extraordinary times. And they prioritise that over team selection. We all wax lyrical over Ben Foulkes' glove work in the second test. But in the three test matches this winter that were played, the person with the second highest average is Jos Buttler. He averaged 47 across those three tests, and he was sent home at the end of the first test. I'm not saying that the decision to send him home was the wrong one within the context of what England were trying to achieve with this winter schedule and how they wanted to manage their players. That was entirely understandable, but it did mean that England didn't have all of the resources that they needed to face the toughest tour. You might argue it's the toughest tour. It's for English players, I think it's tougher than the Australian tour. So, you know, they were slightly hamstrung by those circumstances. But I don't want to make any excuses, because what you've got to do really is look at what India have achieved here without their batters firing. Rohit Sharma, yes, a good 160, splendid 160, and a couple of other contributions. But the top order didn't. Shubman Gill didn't, Pujara didn't, Kohli didn't, Rahane didn't. They were got out of trouble on a couple of occasions when England fought back in ways that we didn't see happening. But England did. They showed a lot of spirit. And when they fought back, it was the likes of Rishabh Pant, Washington Sundar, Akshar Patel, Ravichandran Ashwin with that 100. It was lower down the order. And you know, that shows great depth. It shows fantastic game awareness, fighting spirit, and a knowledge that, you know, just because you're 4-5 down, you don't now have to start panicking and fling the bat. If you have batters who can bat, then bat. So, you know, you've got to take your hats off to India. They played superbly.
Interesting points there. And I think the most relevant for me is squad rotation, because I think there are some pertinent questions that need to be asked there. I mean, are you telling me that England, for the first time in their entire cricketing history, did not prioritize test cricket or test series in India? Or, I mean, the fact that they have prioritized to an extent the T20 World Cup, yes, you have the bio bubble restrictions, you have the COVID restrictions, yes, it's all there. But now this question mark comes into my mind that India are also touring England later this year. Indian cricketers play as much cricket as the English cricketers, if not more. I think they play a little more. But let's just say India go to England and then they also say, okay, listen, what, we're going to rotate our squad as well. So Virat Kohli will only play the first two test matches and then he's going to go home, and half the side is going to go home after the fourth test, and we'll have a completely B-string side in the fifth test match. Are you telling me the English media is going to be okay with it? I have nothing against the English media. It's just I have toured England twice or thrice, and sometimes you observe such things. And one of the observations I made was, I'm not going to take the name of the writer because I respect him, but sometimes you disagree with what certain people write, and I'm not going to take his name, but this was something that I disagreed with, and that was the last tour when India lost at the Oval. They lost the series 3-1, and then they went on to lose the Oval match. They fought hard, but they lost the Oval match. So they lost the series 4-1. And the gentleman wrote that, you know, the BCCI should refund the fans' money because it's been a poor series. It's a poor return in that sense. But that's
lunacy, because, I mean, that series was one of the most gripping series for a long time.
Absolutely.
It could easily have been 3-2 to India in that series. It was a series of very tightly fought matches that went one way and the other. There was one outright spanking that India gave to England at Trent Bridge in that series, and other than that, the other four matches were pretty tight. So,
let me add. And in the 2014 series, the gentleman again wrote a similar article where India lost 3-1, if I remember correctly, in 2014. Look, everybody is right, entitled to their opinion and everything, but for me, what I'm getting at is that the English media would perhaps criticize the Indian team a bit more if they had a similar rotation policy in England later this year. Or, for example, if you look at how the Australia series played out for India, Australia, let's be honest here, Cricket Australia and its broadcasters needed that Indian tour. They absolutely needed that Indian tour, because when the pandemic set in, one of the news that came out of Australia was that Cricket Australia's finances were not looking that great. That Indian tour was worth $300 million to Cricket Australia. And they built it around Virat Kohli. Everywhere you go, every advertisement, everything throughout the Test series, throughout the ODIs, T20s, they spoke only about Virat Kohli. And it was a big blow for them when Virat Kohli went home. So my point here is that there's a bit of double standard in here. I mean, sometimes the Indian team is criticized for matters which are out of our hands. I'm not criticizing the English team for rotation, but what I'm just saying is that when you are leading 1-0 in India, which not many teams do, and then you go on and make 9 changes across 2 test matches, play a bowler short in 4th test match, and of course you're somebody like Jos Buttler, Moeen Ali, Johnny Bairstow, players who should be playing all 4 test matches, they are not part of the squad. Questions should be asked. I think England have prioritized the wrong part of the tour. If they wanted to send their players home, the ODIs and T20s were perhaps the better time to do it. They should have absolutely prioritized the test series in India.
Well, I think you'll find that you're probably in agreement with large sections of the English media on that, because they have actually.
Okay.
they have said precisely that. There's been quite a lot of criticism of that rotation policy. I'm afraid that I don't really know where I stand on it. And I'll tell you for why, because England's winter began with a series out in South Africa that was then called off because of COVID. So they were in a bubble there. They were in bubbles with the IPL bubble before that, a lot of their players. They then had a couple of weeks off, went to Sri Lanka and were faced with the prospect for some players, say Ben Stokes, for example, if he was going to play every game, he was going to be out in a bubble, in effect, from around about the 2nd of January until potentially the beginning of June. Now, that's 5 months because he's got IPL contract that would come after that, and we know the IPL is going along a bit late. So I can see that the England management did have a bit of a tricky issue here. How they were going to manage all of those players across all of those months in bubbles. And they came to this conclusion. The conclusion was that, you know, people would have time off and it would be scheduled and people would know in advance. Now, if this was a long-term way in which England did their selection, if the next time they go to India and they're not in a bubble and they do this, I think stronger questions will be asked. I think those questions are being asked even now, but I remain somewhat agnostic because the players themselves bought into this. You know, they were part of these decisions. So, do you know, it's not ideal. It's suboptimal.
Yeah,
England had to face the consequences of coming to those decisions. Whichever decision they made was going to be the wrong one for some people.
When you were making that point, and it was a very valid point, I was trying to just count in my mind how many Indian cricketers have been in similar sort of bio bubble. I mean, you were recounting Johnny Bairstow's long winter. You look at somebody like Shubman Gill, entered the bio bubble for IPL throughout Australia, similar for Rishabh Pant, now another bio bubble. They'll continue to be part of the T20 sides, T20 ODI sides, and then suddenly you have another IPL bubble. So it's been one bubble after another. Yes, it's very easy to criticize them, but I understand that England are rotating. Virat Kohli also said that there might be some rotation policy, but for the life of me, I don't see it happening in the World Test Championship, in the IPL or India's tour of England. Because let me be very honest, I think, and now let's talk about India a bit more. I think there are two very vital Test series coming up for India this year, apart from the T20 World Cup and of course the World Test Championship final now. India's tour of England, India's tour of South Africa. These are two series that India can win. There is absolutely no doubt in my mind that India can win those series, especially in England, where the pitches will be really helpful for their fast bowlers. I think it's just a matter of their batting coming to form. And you can't have another series where Pujara, Virat and Rahane don't score big hundreds. Rohit, it'll be a big test for him to go to England and score runs. Shubman Gill, he'll be found out. I'm not sure Rishabh Pant can play those sort of shots against James Anderson in Trent Bridge or at Lord's for that matter. But, you know, Rishabh Pant surprises us all. So it'll be a very, very great contest. I think India have a very good nucleus of their test side. You look at Washington Sundar. I mean, this guy played first-class cricket last time in 2017, and he's just gotten short of a maiden test 100 4 years later. He's played 3 or 4 test matches this year. He's been marvelous, absolutely marvelous. A spin bowling all-rounder. While India have Ashwin and Jadeja and Akshar, who can bat a bit as well. So Indian bench strength, formidable as ever, looking ever more stronger. A lot of people have asked me and a lot of people have discussed this with me. Is this the onset of India's domination of world cricket? Just throwing a stat up to you. I was just looking at India's FTP until 23. India has 3 home test series. One is New Zealand. The other is Sri Lanka. The third is Australia. I don't see any of them beating India. Maybe Australia can challenge India. Maybe, because that's what they did last time around. They certainly cannot beat India. I don't see Sri Lanka and I don't see New Zealand beating India. India travel away to, like I said, England and South Africa this year. next year they don't have any overseas test commitments apart from Bangladesh. I don't see India being challenged a lot in majority of those series. Maybe England and South Africa will be a different challenge. Maybe Australia at home. There's a bit of a slip between the lip and the cup. But my thing here is, yes, India needs to achieve that dominance, but they could be on the cusp of that dominance.
Oh, without a doubt they could, because they've got such an adaptable side. The one slight problem they'll have in England is that they have to have a very different composition of the side. So they'll have to go in there with three seamers, and they don't have really a seam bowling all-rounder for English conditions, which means that if they go in with six batters and five bowlers, then what that could be Jadeja and Ashwin at seven and eight, and then you have three seamers. But it suddenly feels a little bit different from what they've been able to go in here, certainly with the last couple of test matches. And England seamers will come into play. I mean, there's no doubt about it. James Anderson, Chris Wokes and Stuart Broad have got phenomenal records in England. So for India to be sort of thought of in the way that we think of the great West Indies sides of the 70s, 80s and early 90s, and the great Australian sides of the turn of the century, the early part of this century, they've got to be able to win dominantly away from home. That's what the West Indies did. They won wherever they played. Australia won pretty much, apart from India, wherever they played. So I think South Africa will be a challenge. I don't think South Africa's got the strongest batting lineup at the moment. And I think India would prevail over there. England is going to be their toughest test.
Yeah,
largely, like I say, because of what they have to do to the composition of their side in order to get the right team for those conditions. But look, there are so many good young players. The depth of Indian cricket was really brought to the fore in the Australia series more than this series against England. The fact that they could cope with so many injuries, so many people having to leave the squad and still prevail in Australia tells you a great deal about the depth they have. They've got young players, so you know, they're not a 100% mature team. Shubman Gill, you've mentioned there. Will he be found out in England? He's a fantastic player. He might find the solutions. Rishabh Pant has played in England before, scored 100. He might prosper. There are great young players, great young fast bowlers, the likes of Siraj, Saini. There's lots of talent coming through, and it's come through perversely, you might say, from T20. A lot of these guys you alluded to, Washington Sundar, has not played a great deal of first-class cricket at all. People said that T20 was going to be the death of Test cricket. It's actually brought to the fore some really tremendous young talents who have cut their teeth in a highly competitive environment against the very best players. And I think that's part of it, you know. A lot of young Indian players grow up playing their cricket with some of the best players in the world. That means, you know, you're training with the best players in the world. You're talking to the best players in the world. And they're not just talking about T20 when they're playing for their IPL franchise. They're picking the brains of great cricketers like AB de Villiers and Chris Gayle, who's played 100 test matches. So, you know, they have a natural inbuilt advantage through population size, through wealth, through now talent scouting and getting the best or better out of their gigantic resources than they were doing in the past. So I wouldn't be at all surprised if this is the start of a dominant Indian decade. It could go on for longer than that. The thing about cricket, though, and any sport, is there's always 11 players. And when 11 play against 11, you can find 11 very, very good players. You know, if you put the great Australia team of 2000 up against this India team on a neutral venue, it'd still be a really, really tough encounter. And that's a country of 20 million against a country of 1 billion. The same would be true of the West Indies back in the 70s. So the wonderful thing about sport is that it always provides for competition, and countries will go through cycles. At the moment, I think England are what they look like. They look like the third or fourth best team in the world. India are what they look like. They look like the best team in the world. They'll get a great opportunity against New Zealand to be crowned World Test champions. But, you know, That will be a really interesting indicator of how India get on against England, because New Zealand have got a team that's really suited to English conditions, and they're going to have played two games in England before. They'll have had, in effect, their two warm-up games, a bit like England had against Sri Lanka.
Yeah.
New Zealand are going to have against England in England.
And India will be coming off the back of an IPL season and a bit of a quarantine ahead of the World Test Championship final. Look, we don't know what the logistics are for that are going to be, but that is the final topic of discussion, India and New Zealand in the World Test Championship final. Daniel, off the podcast, we have discussed a few times what this means for the World Test Championship final. I can tell you, Indian cricket fraternity, fans, media, everyone alike, they are so excited. We are seeing this as the final of the World Cup of Test cricket. And that's how it should be built up because, yes, there's been a pandemic. Yes, a few matches haven't been played. Yes, the rules were meddled and changed and everything. But at the end of the day, Test cricket is sacrosanct for everybody who loves cricket. And when you have a World Test Championship final, that has a very good ring to it. For the first time ever, we are going to have a definitive team that is probably going to be the top of the Test pedestal. And New Zealand are, I mean, yes, India are world number one in Test rankings right now, but New Zealand beat them at home 2-0 very, very easily. Look, I think that's a fantastic opportunity for us to lay down a pathway for Test cricket. We saw what India's win in 2007 did for T20 cricket. It just exploded. It brought the IPL, it brought the T20 leagues. It made sure that every cricket nation took international T20 cricket seriously. Up until then, Australia were not taking T20 cricket seriously. India were not taking T20 cricket seriously. England were there or thereabouts. People started taking T20 cricket seriously. Look at what it has become. It has become a sport in itself. It has become a monster, money-making monster, a monster that is helping cricket grow. And maybe that day is not far off when we will see T20 cricket in the Olympics, hopefully in our lifetimes. The crux of my point is that India in the World Test Championship final makes a lot of sense for the game, for the format. And not to mention, this is a team which was top of the World Test Championship table. The rules were changed, which meant that they had to win. In Australia, they won. Second and third string 11s. There is no other team which deserves more to be in the World Test Championship final. It could be a shot in the arm for Test cricket.
I agree. I mean, I think the two most deserving teams are there, you know, because the thing about New Zealand is it's a tiny country which doesn't generate an awful lot of money.
Yeah.
And it plays way, way, way above itself. Certainly has done for the last 5 or 6 years. And it's led by Kane Williamson absolutely brilliantly. They're the most underrated side in world cricket, with some of the most underrated cricketers, the likes of Neil Wagner, Trent Bolt, Tim Southee, Clark Jameson. I mean, they have a great battery of fast bowlers themselves and some very proficient test batters. So it's a beautiful story because there'll be lots of people who are fascinated and are supportive of India. It'll generate interest in test cricket throughout India. And there'll be lots and lots of neutrals who will all be cheering on New Zealand as the plucky underdog. My fear is that it's a tie and India win on boundary count, because that would really be an absolute disaster. let's keep our fingers crossed that doesn't happen.
I love the Kiwi people. I love New Zealand. I think a lot of New Zealand cricket fans will lose the will to live if that happens. I mean, I am more depressed about that final, that World Cup final, than probably Kane Williamson was. I was like, how the hell are you not angry? Look, that thought, as much as I support and love Team India, we all, I mean, a lot of Indian cricket fans, New Zealand is their second team. And I can't think of this. I can't think of this possibility right now. I want to tell our listeners, I'm thankful that there's a reserve day in prospect for the World Test Championship final. 18th to 22nd of June, 23rd of June as the reserve day, so that we have a result, even if there's rain, keeping the English conditions in mind. The venue hasn't been decided. People are saying Lords. It is not Lords at the moment. I can confirm it. It's probably going to be Aegeus Bowl. I've also heard Edgbaston could be in the running, but I doubt that. Most probably it's going to be the Aegeus Bowl, but things can change. Hey, so we'll continue to keep an eye on that. But
the reasoning, Chetan, could very likely come down to a ground which has a hotel on site.
Exactly,
The COVID situation being the way it is. So during the last summer, for those of you listening who weren't aware, England played their test series against West Indies and Pakistan at the Aegeus Bowl in Southampton and Old Trafford because there were hotels there. So
yeah,
all the players basically lived
the Hilton. Yeah, the Hilton is there.
We would stay, all of us, the players and the broadcasters could all stay there on site. Now, because the COVID situation's unknown, it's improving markedly in England. It has done since the big vaccine rollout. Case numbers are dropping dramatically. But if you want to plan something, when there's a pandemic around, it's probably best to plan with disaster in mind.
Yes.
So the best place to be doing that from could very well be one of those two grounds. It could be Edgbaston, but I would expect it to be Southampton. And the conditions in Southampton are quite variable. They're quite difficult to predict.
Yeah.
You can get quite fast, bouncy pitches that help the seamers. You can also get a fair bit of spin and turn there. So, look, it's going to be a great occasion. I mean, I would hope to be a part of it. I will obviously, I'm afraid, so close your ears, Chetan, but I'll be supportive of New Zealand. Possibly, it's possible that, and I felt this about this test match, actually, that because I support test cricket more than I support any particular nation, I might think it's probably better for the game if India win, because it will generate an enthusiasm for the form of the game that I love the very, very most. And if that's what's needed to make sure that it survives, then go India.
Yeah. Well, I'll just say this, that there are two grounds in England with hotels there, and both of them Hiltons, if I'm not wrong. One is the other is Manchester. Let me tell you what the Indian fans would like. Not a repeat of India New Zealand. Let it be anywhere in England except Manchester. We don't want what happened last time around to read any more wrong pitches, any more rain delays, or anything of that sort. Look, it's going to be a cracker. I cannot wait for the World Test Championship. By the looks of it, I can see Daniel can't also wait. But right now, we'll have to wait for the start of the T20 series, which is coming to us on the 12th of March. And as always, Daniel and I will be previewing the T20 series and talking about the first T20. And that'll come to you. That episode will come to you on Thursday, the 11th of March. Hopefully, you will tune in then, as you have tuned in throughout the test series. Thanks for your support and thanks for listening. Until next time, it's me, Chetan Narula, and Daniel Narcross saying goodbye.
Goodbye.